You are based in
Great.
Pune, I think.
I shifted to Bangalore a week back, so
Oh,
still
recently.
lots of unpacking, and it's such a hassle moving houses, but I'm very excited about Bangalore now.
It's the place to be for a startup.
Yeah, I mean, I think the science and technology scene is quite quite nice here,
Yeah.
with so many institutes like IISc. They are public lecture. I think that's what I'm most excited about.
The atmosphere of learning, the atmosphere of innovation.
Yeah.
So when this whole pandemic happened, where were you? You were in Pune?
Yeah, I was in Pune. I've been in Pune for 6 years.
Okay, so Wingify was born there.
Yeah, no, Wingify was actually born in Delhi. So I'm originally from Delhi, and sort of I wasn't born there, but grew up my entire life, started Wingify there, and about 6 years back moved to Pune because I got bored of Delhi.
Sure.
And also, I mean, it's not a city with pollution, so much pollution, really worth living in. So moved to
Right.
Pune after 6 years, got bored of Pune, so now in Bangalore.
That's one of the beauties of being in an industry where geography isn't as important as
Yeah.
a good internet connection.
Yeah. I mean, we are all remote now, Wingify, 250 people.
Right.
So I could
250.
be,
Wow.
yeah, we could be practically, I mean, I could be practically anywhere. So that's a blessing.
Man, when I was growing up, that was my dream. And I thought I would never be able to do it because a doctor is very, very rooted in geography. So you have to be, in fact, it's, a doctor is rooted in both time and place. You have to be there at that time in order to
Yeah,
earn.
that's true.
And what this pandemic has actually allowed me personally to do is to just explore a life outside the hospital.
Okay.
So in a weird way,
And
I'm very grateful.
what sort of life outside the hospital?
So what I did was I started taking clinics for medical students,
Okay.
and that led me to start putting up videos on neuroscience on my YouTube channel.
Oh, you started during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Last June.
Okay.
And that one thing led to another, basically. And I realized that there are people sharing my love of neuroscience. And I got
It's
to.
a, I mean, it's a fascinating subject. I can't imagine anyone not being interested in neuroscience.
Yeah, that's the weird thing, though, that medical students aren't taught neurology in that way. It's taught in a very clinical academic way of how to save lives when something goes wrong. But the beauty of neuroscience is all the things that happens when it goes right. And
Right.
that is not talked about.
Yeah. I recently finished this. I mean, it was an amazing course called Medical Neuroscience on Coursera. And it was all about anatomy. And I got crazy trying to learn the names of different nerves and different, like, nerve endings, and it's a lot of anatomy, the whole neuros, I mean neurology essentially, right? I mean neuroscience, prior to that, I was more aware of abstract principles, right, in terms of say neural nets and other higher level abstractions. But I guess in medicine it's really about anatomy and diagnosis of how things go wrong.
Yeah, it is. When you're talking of medicine, we are talking of which area has malfunctioned and what is the effect of this area malfunctioning. Whereas neuroscience is more abstraction and concept level discussion. That what would this entire network do? A network need not be anatomically grounded to one area. It usually all networks include the whole brain.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating bit, how a concept gets represented across this whole network and perhaps is not localized per se.
Yeah. It's not. So even in the evolution of our understanding of neurology, we went from localized to global networks. So for one good example is the emotion of fear. So earlier, the idea was that you must have heard of the left brain, right brain hypothesis. Yeah. So artists work from the right brain and logical people work from the left brain. And after that, there was this whole idea that each emotion has a separate center. Yeah. So people would talk about fear center and anger center. Yeah. And there is one area called as the amygdala, which has been notoriously misrepresented as the fear center in the brain.
Right. I mean, I find it fascinating how we are driven to sort of really try to understand things component by component. In reality, brain is such a complex system that it's really hard to say what's the function of any part of the brain, right?
Is this only applicable to neurology, or is it also seen in all systems in life? Our attempt to localize something to one area.
Right. I think it's, when it comes to biology and especially things which are self-organized and evolved, it's hard to say what's the function of XYZ, right? It's involved in so many things, in so many different contexts at so many levels that just saying, that the function of X is Y, I think it's quite misleading. That's what I was thinking when people say, for example, what's the function of sleep? Mm. I feel it's really equivalent to saying what's the function of being awake. It's just a million things. Similarly, function of sleep very likely is a similar order of magnitude, different things.
One of the interesting ways in which we have progressed in our knowledge or understanding is to find out the function, try and understand what happens when we remove it.
Right.
And then we can see all the ramifications of its actions. And they tried that with sleep, since you bring it up. They made mice not sleep and they died, essentially. So make of it what you want. So that's quite straightforward. Yeah. In a startup, right, in a small team, how do you take this exact discussion that we had and try to correlate it there? Because in a startup, everybody has a label. You are head of PR, you are assistant to the manager. So these are all labels, and everybody has their set of roles or functions. You can exactly identify that this person has to do this. But do you think that is an old way of thinking, and we can go towards a more everybody does everything system?
Rather than everybody doing everything, I think that's practically not possible. And possibly that's also not happening in different evolved systems like brain. I think it's the right metaphor is perhaps this self-organized nature, wherein rather than very strict hierarchy from top to bottom, information flows, in all different directions. And perhaps it's also not very strictly hierarchical. There are sort of just connections going from the bottom to middle, or maybe bottom to top directly. And I feel that's how efficient organizations work, wherein they keep on reconfiguring who does what based on circumstance and based on what needs to be done. So in that context, for example, if you say head of marketing, that label becomes misleading because the organization requires to solve different problems at different points of time. So you can't just force fit. It's like, you will get like a hammer for every problem you come across. But in many cases, you might not need a hammer. So that's why I think having a team that's very, very context dependent in terms of what functions end up getting done by different people and how is the structure also laid out is quite important.
So when you talk of fluid systems in the brain, the term would be feedback. that every connection has a feedback to tell the first neuron what the second neuron has told the third neuron. So the first neuron has to know that. So there is always a feedback loop. It can be positive, it can be negative. Usually it's both. And traditional systems in societies didn't have that. It was unidirectional. The king will tell the ministers will tell the public. That's it.
Right.
But I suppose in a way, democracy was one way of looping it around. That right. The public had a way of giving feedback to the people on top.
Right. I do think there's very interesting parallels in the sense of, say, the whole organism when you talk about, say, homeostasis, which is really, to maintain survival, essentially, what you need to be doing, getting food, getting water, and breathing, and so on, and so being safe, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, I find it very interesting that there is no central commander out there. I think everyone shares that goal. And essentially, I think there is a lot of cooperation going on within the body, but everyone is selfish because they know if that cooperation is successful, everyone wins. So in a very similar way, I feel as the organization grows, especially, I think people overestimate the amount of influence a CEO or a chairman or even a founder can have in the organization. Mm-hmm. After a point, maybe even beyond 50 people, you can't practically just direct who does what. Mm-hmm. That's where designing a self-evolving sort of a team wherein everyone knows what is the end goal, the homeostatic goal for the organization, becomes very similar. And I think that involves all sorts of feedback, right? Wherein the CEO doesn't tell how to do something, but really, what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. So the CEO is more concerned with the vision and not the everyday practicalities of how to solve each and every problem.
Yeah, because it's practically impossible. There is a reason we have our different systems within our body, right? Brain practically cannot just do everything in the body.
At what point is that switch? Because I'm sure when you are starting off, when you have just founded, you cannot immediately get to that abstract level of thinking where I will only think about vision. I'm sure there must be some months to years where you are directly involved in the everyday.
Yeah. I think it's really to do with the cost of communication. Initially with few people, there's hardly any cost to communication. You're all in the same office. You can talk, align, and everyone knows what needs to get done. But I think as you grow, the cost of communication, efficiently communicating, becomes very costly because there is misunderstanding across levels. You say something, people understand something else. So you have to keep on sort of doing that. And after a period of time, it's just not worth specifying a task in utmost detail because it's just impossible to align, 200 people and everyone, there is this ambiguity, right? You say X and they understand X plus Y. So that's where very you feel, it's becoming very costly to efficiently communicate. Yeah. Then you try to communicate less. And when you try to communicate less, then I think what needs to happen becomes much more important as compared to how to do that specific thing. And delegation just emerges naturally.
It's like the language of the group is evolving.
Yeah.
So we are bracketing more and more actionable items under lesser and lesser words.
Right. Yeah. And that's why the founding team becomes very important. Wherein, for example, if I think about me and my co-founder, then I think there are instances where just a few words carry such a significant amount of meaning that if I were to communicate with someone who I have not spent enough time with, I would have to probably write long documents, sit with them, explain. So that efficiency, is amazing. The more time you spend with someone, the less you need to tell them exactly what you mean.
Right. There are these words which have been used to a point of cliche, like bandwidth. and wavelength, but I'm pretty sure that anybody who has been in the industry long enough knows that, I mean, these are relatable concepts. These actually do matter.
Yeah, I mean, the concept sort of, if they exist, they serve a purpose. We can laugh about them, but that won't stop people from using it because they're being helpful.
The parallel with biology here is so strong because our body evolved from unicellular organisms to multicellular organisms on the basis of communication. Effective communication was the one driver of evolution. In fact, if you want to look at it as a marker of evolution, we can. The more effectively two cells or three cells or 100 billion cells can communicate, the more successful that organism is. And the whole story of the nervous system is that.
Right. Yeah.
It is. It is just as a marker of efficiency of communication.
Yeah. It's also interesting that it's in interest of each cell to communicate effectively. I think naively we may assume that each of our cells is sort of like, you know, selfless or being altruistic, composing our bodies, being us. But I think it's in best interest of each of our cells to make up this person, Paris or Sid, who will protect those cells by, you know, getting adequate food and taking shelter. I mean, if each of our cells were by themselves, it would have been relatively so much difficult. I mean, single cellular organisms' whole strategy is to replicate so fast, say E. coli replicating every 20 minutes, that if it dies, it dies. But our cells, they sort of take comfort in making up this bigger entity. And I think the same thing is, if you think about it, why people join organizations versus everyone being a freelancer. I think there is a very interesting parallel theory. I think the person was called Robert Coase, if I'm not mistaken. And he's the person who researched, why do people actually join forces in an organization? Why can't everyone be a free agent? And if markets are so efficient, it makes sense for nobody to enter into a contract and join an organization where because markets unlock more efficient. So you might actually get paid extra if you were a freelancer. And his precise observation was that organizations exist because the inefficiency of communication in a free market would sort of, you know, kill all the efficiencies that may otherwise exist. So if you are just constantly switching different contexts, that the same efficiency that we're talking about, you know, doesn't come about. So when a new person joins, for example, in marketing team, and they take a few months to onboard, that is where this unified language of the organization does its magic.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's the equivalent of trying to get into a relationship with somebody who speaks Spanish or Latin every few months.
The language keeps on changing.
Right.
So you might not be able to get anything done because by definition, the task cannot be so well specified, you know, all the time. Our language is just ambiguous.
And mistakes are bound to happen irrespective of language, but the rate at which feedback can be given and learning can happen is also dependent on the effectiveness of the communication.
Right. Again, I think similar parallels to biology again and the brain. I think organizations have memories just like people. And that's why, I mean, sometimes I'm amazed that in companies, you can replace everyone over a period of time, but the culture remains. And that's why they say the culture is so hard to change. And even if everyone who was, you know, initially in the company changes, but because people keep on passing the baton in terms of their implicit behaviors, that synthesis remains, you know, the backbone of the company. In a very similar way, where our cells can keep on changing, but our self, we feel like a unified whole.
Yeah, our identity remains.
Yeah, and similar way, companies do have identities which are just extremely hard to change. Mm-hmm. Very much like people, wherein people's personalities are extremely hard to change. I think it's just to do with a lot of implicit, unsaid knowledge that just is spread out and not contained within, you know, any particular person.
Yeah, this concept is from Ship of Theseus.
Yeah.
Identity being more than just the sum of its parts. When we talk of evolution of now we are talking of two things in parallel and seems to be working very well of organisms and startups. The one of the evolutionary drivers is this seesaw effect of cooperation and competition. What has been noticed is that organisms who go for only one of these don't tend to do very well. And organisms who have figured out how to do both of this with each other, with the members of their own species, they tend to do very well.
Yeah, I think exactly same with startups, wherein, you know, sometimes they'll get into partnerships with other companies, and at, in other contexts, they'll end up competing. And I think this is where the parallels go, because the competition in business is very much like competition between individuals in evolution, wherein you cannot just have a rigid strategy, right? If you have a rigid strategy that I'll always cooperate or I'll always compete, you will be sort of, you know, outcompeted by someone else. So, and similarly in startups, you can't be just inflexible that you'll, I mean, essentially the key to success, I think, in evolution or in startups is being very tuned into the context in which you currently find yourself in and trying to just gain whatever advantage you can within that context.
Adaptability.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a difficult thing to wrap your head around, because it's the concept of ships versus boats. We want the stability of a ship. Discipline or preconceived notions give us that. That this is our culture. This is what we believe in. No matter what, we're going to stay on this course. And that is comforting. But it's not very, that system isn't designed for quick changes. So you can't turn it around very quickly. Smaller startups, smaller boats, I think they have that advantage.
Yeah, I mean, the startups are completely undefined when they are starting. And I think that's the number one advantage they have over bigger organizations. That so it's for bigger organizations, funding is never a constraint. People is never a constraint. And I also think it's a misunderstanding to think there are no smart people there. They're as smart people in bigger organizations as startups. But the reason bigger companies are not able to sort of adapt very quickly is precisely the fact that, you know, it's a complex beast. Different people have different incentives. There is a lack of proper communication. There's just so many things which make it hard to turn the ship around, even if the CEO wants to. That's the main point, because so many transformation stories of big companies end up failing because CEO does not have as much leverage as people assume. And precisely the opposite for the startup. You are four people in a garage. You can just do whatever you want to.
And become anything. The whole evolutionary tree is open to you.
Yeah, that's true. And I think technology gives such a significant leverage that four people tech company can end up creating more value than like a 50,000 people non-tech company, because essentially tech is nothing but, you know, you have outsourced work to technology. So on the surface, it feels like 4-person company, but when you're coding things up, you're essentially replicating infinite number of other people, because algorithms are nothing but that. So it can just keep on scaling. And that's why I think there is thinking about companies' potential in terms of number of people is, I think, quite misleading. Because technology just changes what you call a person effectively, right?
And not just a person, generations of people. Technology has essentially outsourced the scalability quotient of evolution. So one person can live through several generations of experience because of technology.
What do you mean?
In terms of, if evolution had to make a change, it had to iterate something, then it would have to go through several generational cycles of trial and error, reproduction, trial and error. Technology essentially outsources that. So the scale at which iteration can happen in technology completely cancels out any physical advantage that somebody may have of having more number of people.
In fact, because, in those contexts, it becomes a disadvantage. If your business depends on hiring people, there is a physical limit to how fast you can hire, train, coach, communicate. But if it's about, you know, you open up your ID and code something up and just push it on AWS, then it's just, there's no limit. You can spawn one worker or you can spawn a million workers. And it can just scale in an instant effectively.
Did you start as a coder or did you start as a founder, or is there no difference?
I mean, I love coding, but I'm not like a proper engineer. I'm more like a hacker, where I'll sort of put things out that work, but they're not beautiful to look at. So if for example, if I'm building a bridge, I'll build something quickly that works out well, but it may not be, you know, very beautiful to look at.
It won't win any design awards, but
but it'll get the job done and get the job done effectively and at a good pace. So I think being founder came later to me, but growing up, I was just coding things left, right, and center. And I realized that the very same thing, right? That you don't need to build factories to make a lot of money. You can actually just have a laptop and code something useful, and it can scale as much as factories if you make something useful.
At what age did you earn your first dollar or first rupee because of something that you coded?
I think it was probably 14. Yeah.
You were 14 years old.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
I remember getting $100 from someone in Australia. And they wanted to modify the source code of a program I'd written. So they sent $100 through Western Union. I went with my mom. And I still remember that day, like, got a bundle of 5,000 rupees. And my mom told me, don't tell the Western Union guy that, you know, you coded something, say he's a relative. So yeah, it was a fun thing. It was a great feeling to get. I mean, this is what I find fascinating. And to this date, I find fascinating that what I build and what we now build, which is an A/B testing software, it's literally some instructions on a text file. It's somehow through a network of different links getting converted into, you know, things that I'm eating, buying, like the physical stuff. So literally the instructions that are on a text file, they're ending up getting me practical everything that I want in the physical world.
Right.
So I don't know, I mean, why I find it fascinating, but I find it fascinating that you don't have to start with creating something physical to ultimately have your physical needs satisfied.
So in a way, isn't all creativity that? Like all art, let's talk of art. So if somebody is an artist, if somebody is a poet or a singer, and he or she is making their living through that, they are not creating anything physical. Right? It is just...
I mean, at one level that I think boundary gets blurred, right? If you really sort of are rigorous about it, everything is physical. There's no such thing as, you know, unphysical reality. But still, I feel that the amount of probably I don't know how to sort of characterize it. Is it the amount of effort that seems sort of lopsided? That probably the effort put into writing code is not as much as the things I enjoy as a product of it. Right. Because, you know, I've been able to, for example, buy a laptop through code, this mic and so on. And it feels a lot of physical effort is went into it. Some people have packed it. Some people have shipped it. Some people have carried it. Some people have cooked the food. Some people have grown it. And all of that physical effort is a result of me putting some intellectual effort. I think that's the disconnect, you know, I feel very fascinated with. And I wonder how much that can scale. And I think in some context, for example, in context of WhatsApp, where when it sold, it was 19 engineers or 20 engineers in a 50-person company. And I think valued at $19 billion.
Billion, yeah.
And I imagine how much of wheat or rice can you buy
$19
billion.
So
it just seems like the scale of technology, I think, is completely unappreciated.
You know how they say that if you're an Indian and you go to the US and if you're buying bread or if you're buying milk, they tell you, stop converting, stop converting it into rupees, you'll go nuts. So I think we're talking about that across technological advancement. Like you have to stop converting.
But you know, here's the thing. We can live without WhatsApp, but we cannot live without like wheat or rice or many of the physical things. So that is, I think, the irony wherein something you can live without is getting to buy a lot of things which are valuable for survival.
Right. But that is what social evolution does. In that once it will value, it will give the highest value to the thing which is the most recently evolved or the most difficult to get. So if now for some reason all our food runs out, the importance that we give to code is going to drastically drop.
Yeah.
Right. Because we will, I know that Maslow's pyramid has flaws, but it is still a great way of imagining where our priorities lie. The reason that we give importance to code is because our food and our health is taken care of. And unless code can solve that, which it is now getting very close to, but first principle thinking.
Yeah. I mean, it's ultimately to do with scarcity, right? Whatever is scarce and valuable, there its value sort of shoots up. But I think this ultimately gets us to like property rights, wherein wheat, if you're growing, your neighbor can just get some grains and start growing wheat by himself. But WhatsApp code, you cannot. And I think the whole question is, you know, is it fair that way? Wherein physical things in generally, you cannot protect because you ship them out in the world and they can be copied much easily. While software, you know, resides in your own servers. and nobody has access to it. I think that's one of the reasons also why software generally is much more valuable than hardware.
When we think of Maslow's pyramid, or when we think of first levels thinking, you are somebody who, I read all of your tweets and I find them incredibly enjoyable and thought-provoking. Do you spend time in thinking about your own growth and then think of how much health still plays a role? I know that this is on a different tangent, but how often do you think of health in context to all of this, with startups, with advancement, with technology?
Health, you mean physical health, mental health, or
physical health?
Physical health is number one priority. I do feel everything else depends on me being in a good physical shape and mental shape. So that's absolutely number one priority. So I make sure no matter what, I exercise daily and I meditate daily. So it's become part of the routine.
And, really?
I do feel being fit is important because it just has downstream consequences in everything. You'll not be able to think better. You'll not be able to feel good. And it's not a lot of investment of time, as a matter of fact.
Just 20 minutes or 30 minutes of exercise actually sorts you out.
Yeah, exactly.
People
and
often,
I don't know why, but I think it's one of the highest ROI things that people don't end up doing.
Right. That's a beautiful way of putting it. Just when you talk of physical health, all it takes is 30 minutes every day. And mental health is a little bit more complex, but that is also because it is not as well understood. The reason we know about exercise and the benefits is because we have spent at least 150 to 200 years more in studying physical health than we have in mental health. Reasonably and confident that 50 years later, the conversation will be different.
True. And I do worry about, exactly for the same reason, say social media has been around for say 10 years. And I think nobody has any clue what it's doing to us. I think the way I imagine it is very similar to the first 10 years of cigarettes, where doctors used to smoke, people used to smoke in airplanes. It was just everywhere.
Right.
And only much later we realized how harmful smoking is. I feel very similarly, but social media could be even worse. Because unlike cigarettes, you could be practically be there on social media for entire waking day. And I think it also plays, again, nicotine addiction is bad, but I don't know what this constant dopamine release that you train yourself to get through social media does in the long run. I do feel people, the ability to think deeply is thinning out because people just don't have free time. They are not idle anymore.
Yeah. They don't have free time and they have lost the ability to be still.
Yeah.
There is, if you notice anybody anywhere, say outside a doctor's clinic, they're just waiting for their appointment and they're just sitting. They cannot sit still. Their hands have to reach out to your mobile, to a magazine. If their battery is out, it's like somebody's torturing them.
The smirk is expected, but I think it's a really bad habit that we've trained ourselves to wherein. When it becomes a muscle memory, you know, it's probably not something which is good because I've seen so many people just mindlessly scrolling. They don't even realize they're scrolling sometimes.
Yeah.
After, I think, a minute or so, it hits them that they've forgotten why they picked up the phone.
Yeah.
That's the first app they end up opening, Instagram, Twitter or something. It's become a muscle memory. And if you add up all the time that you end up investing, I won't even call it investing, probably just spending. I think it's a big, big chunk in world. So that's why I think I'm trying to very, very consciously observe my own habits and to ensure, you know, I don't end up just mindlessly just spending time on social media. So that's why I think over the last 1 year, I've just trained myself to not check notifications all the time. So I only tweet, but check notifications once a day and I just slot time for it and that's it. Otherwise, so, I felt I was always...
Yeah, because if you put out one tweet, even if you put out one tweet a day, the responses, the retweets, that is enough to keep you occupied for the rest of that day.
Yeah, and especially because it's variable reward, right? You don't know whether you got two replies, three replies. Yeah. When you're eating, you don't know whether you got another reply. So it's a really, really bad hook for the brain if you let yourself, you know, fall for it.
Right. Then... one of the things that had come out after Facebook released their notification bell icon for the first time was how people, they documented people opening up Facebook. And even before the app was opened, their eyes were already on the spot where the notification would show a red circle with that number.
Wow.
So they don't care about the rest. They don't care about what's on the feed and all that. So even while they were clicking their the app symbol, the eye tracker showed that their eyes are already expectantly gone. Ki chalo kitna wo red ball hai ki nahi. Because that's all you want.
I think all our evolved biases are getting exploited one by one. I feel it's sort of like a gradient descent that happens wherein technology becomes more and more addictive by figuring out one bias after another, right? Where our bias is to sort of be curious what people have said about us. And I think that's a useful bias. Back in the days where you were probably hunter-gatherers, it would have been a survival advantage. But now that bias taken to extreme, having notifications about us every 2 minutes or so, I don't think that's useful at all.
It's such an irony that the things that were designed to keep us alive are being used to exploit us. And it's the ultimate hack.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a continuum of capitalism and consumerism, because even the whole thing with sugar is similar, wherein, but it's still indirect. You take sugar, you feel good. But when you plug into the direct your brain by notifications or similar such things, I think it's taking things to another level to a certain extreme.
The next level after this, I'm assuming it to be virtual reality. Wherein the immersion is deeper, the sensory input is closer, it is more real. And so the amount of dopamine is also much more. So it is the difference between seeing a bungee jump and actually bungee jumping. You get that feeling of the emptiness in your stomach when you've put on a VR headset and you jump off a roof. I've seen people fall down, physically fall down in the real life, because their character fell down.
Yeah.
It is going to be all the more exciting. It is also going to be all the more addictive.
Yeah.
How do you pivot?
Yeah, I am conflicted here because I think nobody should be in authority to tell other people what's good for them. If someone really wants to be on the social media for 12 hours a day, let them be, right? That's the individual choice. So I think I'm very sensitive to the fact that people want to do things that they want to do. And any sort of any sort of like societal over sort of control on it, I see that negatively, right? Because it ends up killing so many things that you don't even realize. I mean, we might be mistaken. For all we know, maybe social media addiction is a good thing. Maybe people are learning much faster. Maybe they are being more creative. Maybe there's an explosion of culture. We don't know. So in that sense, I feel this sort of going to extreme and providing whatever people want to whatever level they expect, I think it's essential, but at the same time, sufficient controls must be given for people who want to switch off.
Right.
I don't think it's binary. Either you do this or do that, but design can be much more thoughtful and holistic so that people do what they want in a very healthy way.
But that design will only be forced upon by an external.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, that's where giving an option to put out that design is important. For example, in Twitter's case, maybe I would love an option wherein they disable notifications so that only if I click on a button, I get to see who replied and I don't get that 19, 20 or so numbers.
Yeah.
And similarly, I would love an option, you know, wherein I just get to open it once. And if I open it up once, it gets locked for the next year. So the number of options that can be there if I really want to and if I'm aware that my habits are progressing in a negative direction. But I don't think you can just end up making an addicting product without giving any sufficient options for a user to derive the utility but not get addicted.
When I hear you say this, I feel that this is something that is very similar to hoping cigarette companies put out those lung cancer pictures of their own accord.
Yeah, that'll never happen. It has to be government mandate.
Right.
But again, the society mandate should not be prohibition. That's why I feel, say, prohibition of alcohol or prohibition of cigarettes or prohibition of even marijuana and other things is a troublesome thing. There should be individual choice. But at the same time, I think society's or government's role is to make sure whoever wants to back off, they can back off, you know, easily.
So before backing off, I feel that the primary job of the society is education, because a lot of times people make that choice without being fully aware of the consequences.
Right.
So in this case, before that, society has to be aware of the consequences itself. We should have the data and the conviction to say that this is what is happening. And then we have to educate people about it.
But even before that, I feel you could still give options assuming something is bad. Because then you delegate the responsibility for making choices, whether something is good or bad, to an individual. So like I think even before education, you can just assume that, you know, there's going to be an addictive nature to something that's being put out. And just to safeguard, it's really like a safeguard strategy, right?
Right. You've been in this world of technology and internet and directly dealing with, I think, more of businesses, right? You're a business-facing enterprise. It's not a consumer-facing enterprise. There is a lot of stress. Every day there are questions to be answered, problems to be solved. Have you developed any system in which you find that this is a reasonable way of dealing with stress? And you feel that this is not how I used to do things before, and now I've figured it out.
Right. I mean, it's just a number of hacks, essentially, or systems. No magic sort of wand there. I think one of the important things is to take out time every day for free thinking. I mean, in the sense of you shouldn't be available all the time for other people to sort of bang at your door and ask you for things, because if you do that, I mean, it used to be like that. And then people would come with their questions, and the urgency and importance of those questions are not calibrated to what you consider urgent and important, but what others consider urgent and important. So your attention keeps on getting diverted at different scales by different people. So it's important to first make sure that you limit the sort of the window in which people can communicate to you, unless, you know, it's extremely like the business is on fire. So that's one. And you have to consciously train yourself. I still remember when, now we are remote, but when we were in office, people would knock, and slowly I started asking, you know, is it urgent? And people would say no. And then I'll say, you know, then no, I can't talk, because that's another way to be stressed all the time. If you feel like attending to people's questions all the time. And I think it's a trap that a lot of managers and founders fall into, because I think evolutionarily our tendency is to please people, and we can't say no. So if someone comes to you with their question, you have a tendency to sort of help them out, which is good. You should help, but you cannot help at the cost of your own stress and your own sort of context switching. So that's one. And I think the second is to making sure you meditate daily. I remember working with a coach, and the first thing that coach said is, you know, that your product is your brain essentially. So even more than physical exercise, you need to make sure you meditate, because if your brain or mind is not at the right place, you'll not be able to work effectively. So I've started sort of meditating daily, and I think it teaches you patience, that there are very, very few things in life which are life threatening. In fact, our modern society has made things so much safe around us that practically nothing is life threatening. But somehow
our brain doesn't know that.
Yeah. Unless we train it to. And I think meditation does that, because when you force yourself to sit for 20 minutes without doing anything, ultimately you end up preaching your brain that, you know, it's safe. The things around you are just safe. And I think that's helped me a lot, wherein I don't really sort of panic that easily. And in fact, I don't recall panicking initially. If a person would go, you know, it'll be like panic and exits for startups, even especially when a critical person leaves. You initially, if you're a new founder, you'll feel like attacked on two fronts. One is that what's going to happen to the company, and second is, I think sometimes you take on your ego also, like, how can this person leave? But over a period of time, once you've seen that nothing really sort of significantly changes, the organization keeps on going on, then, you know, it's becomes okay. You still feel a little bit sad if someone who's good leaves you, but then it's not the end of life sort of feeling. So I mean, a number of things, and even simple hacks, like in Google calendar, the default meeting is 60 minutes, set it to 20 minutes. And I've seen that whatever can be communicated in 60 minutes in a meeting can be communicated in effectively 15 minutes. And if you force that short time, people are more effective. So I've done that. I take sort of 4 hours every day before lunch, absolutely no meetings, no WhatsApp, no emails. I don't check my mails. And that lets me sort of, you know, think deeply and only squeeze meetings in last sort of couple of hours of the day.
So you don't start the days off with meetings, which is what a lot of people would
absolutely
do.
No, I that's, I think, the worst way to start a day, because then you end up trapping yourself in urgent things, and all the important things, I think, keep on sort of getting postponed. In fact, if there is an uncomfortable conversation that happens in a meeting, your day is ruined. But an uncomfortable conversation cannot happen if you don't have any meetings. So that's why you should have them, you know, at the latter part of the day when you've done your sort of individual work.
Right. The trapping happens not just with uncomfortable meeting with other people, but also through social media.
Yeah.
Because now most people get up and switch off the alarm and open whatever app their muscle memory tells them to open. And as soon as they open, they will read some comment and then you are trapped.
Absolutely. I think, and I mean, there is, if you think about it, I can't recall any utility or value of doing that. So much of time can get lost in these social media conversations or even WhatsApp and so on. And you, a lot of times end up feeling bad because strangers can comment anything that they want to.
Right.
So what's the point, right?
Have you had Twitter arguments?
Yeah, not arguments, and people have been mean to me sometimes.
Mm.
And I mean, if they're really, really mean, I end up reporting them to Twitter. But, you know, if they're just mean, I actually sometimes reply to them in their DMs or communicate to them. And I found that if you are sort of, you know, being nice to them, they actually sort of just mellow down. And I've had people who said, particularly who have trolls in their bio, said that, you know, it's very unusual that you're nice to me. And I do feel that if you're nice to trolls, they don't really realize what to reply because they never expected anyone to be nice to them.
Right. Right. Because that's not what they're there for, right? They're there to experience hate.
Yeah.
It's a weird way to get their dopamine, but it's true.
Yeah. And I think it bothered me once or twice, but now I'm sort of not bothered at all, whatever anyone says, because I've realized their opinion really doesn't matter. I mean, I really value negative feedback because it helps me grow and evolve. But if someone is just mean, they're just being mean. If someone says you're stupid without explaining why you're stupid, they're just being mean, right? And why should that bother you at all? Random person's unfounded, unexplained opinion, whose face also you can't see. It's usually just an icon.
Yeah. And there's no credibility. You can't put... Twitter makes us believe that the background of the person doesn't matter. But how could that possibly be true?
Exactly. I mean, maybe they've not thought through what you've written. Maybe they don't have the context that you have. Maybe they're just having a bad day. So putting so much weight on someone's mean comment when they themselves would have likely forgotten 10 seconds after commenting that. It's again one of the hacks that one has to overcome, this evolutionary bias to sort of really obsess about negative feedback. So we do obsess about one negative feedback and conveniently forget 100 positive compliments.
Yeah.
And it's a really weird way evolution has wired us, frankly.
Yeah. I was giving this example of friendly tigers. If we're in the jungle and we come across, or if you're in a big cage and there are 99 friendly tigers and we are playing with them and they're licking our hands and everything is good, but there is one tiger that is slightly growling, who do you think we will pay attention to?
Yeah. And unfortunately, we'll end up having an opinion about all tigers.
Yeah.
That's the worst part, where we forget about that people are different and we just latch onto a label and say all X type of people are like this.
And that's the core root of all isms.
Yes.
The world is changing. There is decentralization happening. You are in the...
I'm not sure of that.
Oh, you're not. Okay, let's talk of that then. Tell me, what's your take on decentralization?
I feel it doesn't sustain. Again, it's not binary that everything is central or everything is decentral. I feel based on the context, there's always some equilibrium that gets reached. And I think a lot of networks started having very decentralized sort of participation. So right from YouTube, where people started putting random videos, to now, which where the top, I think 10, 20 channels are all corporations. It's T-Series, yeah. Vivo, and so on and so forth. It's pretty much centralized. If you see the amount of the power laws start emerging, right? And when power laws start emerging, and 80% of your sort of attention goes to 20% of creators, then those 20% of creators will become more and more efficient. And that's where the centralization happened. And similarly with Wikipedia, where it started with everyone and anyone can edit a page. And now the whole thing is controlled by very few editors who don't let others in. And I think it's a natural tendency of decentralized system to centralize because there are utility in centralizations.
Yeah,
like we said, you know, it's efficient. I mean, coming back to the first point we were talking about, decentralization is like lots of free market agents trying to negotiate all the time. But organizations emerge from those free market agents because it's efficient for those organizations to be. So that's why I feel.
Sorry, Paris, can you repeat that last sentence? It is efficient.
I said it's just efficient to pool in resources. They can do lots of things, right? A corporation can pool in resources. The communication can be faster. There's less negotiated contracts and so on and so forth. Yeah. And that's why I feel any system that starts out as completely decentralized ends up getting centralized in some sense. Even, you know, something like democracy. We don't have a direct democracy. It's just not practically possible. That's why we have a representative democracy. We elect our MPs and they end up making decisions. It's a centralization, right?
Right. So the argument is that all of these power laws have been based on patterns of human behavior. But technology had never progressed to the extent that it has now, where it can take up some of the most complex problems that human beings have had with each other, which was about trust and reliability and safety. So one of the arguments for, say, crypto is that the algorithm will take care of it. You and I don't have to worry about it. And so the reasons for centralization or decentralization and the reasons for the whole game theory gets kind of skewed if the algorithm is managing it. Do you feel there is any strength to this argument?
Not really. I mean, you imagine if they're different agents. I mean, decentralized system in essence is different agents competing with each other. When it comes to cryptocurrency, there's miners who are competing. No matter how much cooperation you talk about, all systems have some level of competition.
Right.
In some context. And when there is competition, different agents will feel it's beneficial for them to pool together and derive common efficiencies. So rather than everyone having their own sort of production system and creating videos, some agents will come together and set up like a production studio.
Right.
And they'll end up creating, you know, more value for the entire network than other single ones. And the forces will just tend to cluster different kinds of free agents into these clusters. So I do feel it's inevitable that some sort of centralization will happen if there is any level of competition, because efficiencies will drive it. No matter what algorithm you say, if there is any efficiency to be exploited, centralization will sort of prop its head.
So what does that mean for a startup like yours, where you may have to make the switch to Web 3.0, for example? Is that a conversation that you guys have?
I don't feel it useful to think in labels, because Web 3.0 is just so many things to so many people.
Right.
So it's more helpful to see what exactly is the problem that needs solving. If there is a problem that needs solving, whether you call it Web 1.0 or 3.0, I think it makes sense for us to do it. But just because some people are talking about this big label Web 3.0, that doesn't sort of drive us at all. That doesn't compel us to do anything.
My understanding of it was islands of internet owned by individuals. But like you said, it has to go from somewhere. It has to go through somewhere. And eventually, it is going all the way back to unicellular organisms. That even if everybody has their own... Facebook was decentralization in some way. Because before that, or before that was Orkut. In Orkut, everybody had their own piece of internet. You had your own landing page. You had your own description. And you had your set of friends. In a way, that was decentralization under the umbrella of an organization.
Yeah. I mean, the whole internet was the prototypical decentralized network, right? The HTTP, where anyone can communicate to anyone else if they sort of agree to a protocol. And then web, the original web with HTML protocol was decentralized. But you see what's happened, wherein the again power laws emerge and most of the traffic goes to the same sort of internet. And even with something as simple as hosting web pages, now we have AWS and these very big hosting providers, because it's just more efficient to host with AWS than set up your node and serve your pages from there. So I think you can derive all the lessons you want about decentralization from internet, which has been there, you know, 20 years in the making.
So then if this is not future proofing, then what is, and this is the last thing that I wanted to discuss with you about, what is the thing that not worries you, but you are on the lookout for the most in the next 5-10 years, the challenges that you think your company will face?
I mean, in terms of our particular industry, I think privacy, in the sense of where you're doing A/B testing, and we are into A/B testing. So there is sort of growing concerns about things like, you know, setting up cookies and tracking people and so on and so forth. So there is an inherent tension between a business wanting to optimize a customer experience, business wanting to optimize their landing page, versus people wanting their privacy and not to be tracked. So we do feel internally, you know, that's one of the challenges wherein the whole internet has to frankly navigate it very carefully, because it can't go either way. If businesses don't know what their customers are doing, then businesses cannot improve, and ultimately end up harming the entire society, because, you know, better products cannot be developed if you're not optimizing and learning about customer behavior. So customer behavior is a very significant input to improving a business. And if that channel cuts off, I think it's ultimately harmful to the business. But at the same time, I'm sympathetic to consumers as well, who do not want to be tracked very, very aggressively, who value their privacy. So
this is like Har Saas Bhi Kabhi Bahut Thi thing. Like every CEO is also a consumer. So when your phone asks you, do you want to allow this app to track you?
I don't.
That's the conflict.
Yeah. That's why I feel, I mean, we are also sort of, I think, excited about this, because this debate is not just, I mean, whatever happens for the business, I think this debate is much larger than just our business. It's ultimately our society's future at stake, right? How much surveillance is an acceptable level of surveillance, and so on. So I'm not stressed per se, because it's important to me personally. But I think in terms of business, we are just very closely watching how this thing plays out.
Right. And in terms of financials, when there is the way that we are all getting paid and when the way that transactions are happening, cash is almost out. Nobody even talks of cash anymore. Digital payment has come and it is already getting replaced. Even before, there are people in my family who haven't downloaded Google Pay, and people are already talking on the other side of how pay me in Ethereum. The speed with which this is changing is so quick.
Yeah.
We think we are the generation that has the ability to adapt quickly. I am having a little question mark in my head.
Yeah.
How quickly is this changing?
Yeah. No, I think one of my biggest fears is to become someone who feels what young ones are doing makes no sense.
Mm.
So I want to consciously train myself to respect the behaviors and ideas of people much younger than us. I think the 15-year-olds of today really know what's going to happen in the next 10 years. So that's really the future, whether we like it or not, whether we're comfortable with it or not. They'll be wrong. They'll make mistakes. But whatever they are doing, you know, by definition, I think that will end up being more relevant in the next 10 years than whatever we are comfortable with today.
Wow. Yeah. And the reason that we feel instinctively like dismissing it is because our amygdala tells us that that is a threat. Let's cancel it quickly.
Yeah. I mean, and because we don't understand it, we don't want to deal with it. We don't want to feel inadequate. So our natural response is to laugh at it and say, you know, it's never going to work. But this is precisely what's happened again and again and again in history.
Yeah.
So if we are smart, we'll know a lot of what's happening today, which feels like a toy, we feel like a gimmick, is going to, you know, end up defining our future.
Brilliant. Paras, thank you so much for joining in, man. This is genuinely one of the most interesting conversations I've had on this podcast.
Same here. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I think the conversation went a lot of places, but I think somehow all of these points seem to be connected. And it's amazing how so many diverse points can have this unified essence, which we, I think, skirted again and again and came back to it. So thank you so much.
Yeah, this felt like a very holistic moment.
Great.
Thanks, man. If I'm in Bangalore, I would love to see you at some point.
Sure. I mean, just buzz me. Love to catch up with you. Come home. We'll have a beer. Then we'll just keep on chatting.
Yeah. I would love that. I'll catch you up on Twitter. I think I'll DM you on Twitter. I think that would be the best thing.
Yes. Sure.
All right. Amazing.
Okay.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
See you.
Take care.
Bye. Take care. Bye. You too, man. Bye.